go. Look, you're a strong woman.
You're just playing over there.
No, no, you got some strength.
No, I am strong, but
I know, but I'm not
playing. You could crush me.
Stronger than Gabriel.
God have mercy on us.
Did I screw that up?
And you can get Listen Up for only $14.99.
But today, we do have a really special guest, Michelle Russell, who, is my wife. And we've been, how long have we been married? We're closing in on 30, aren't
29
we?
29 in June.
You said to me, like, recently that we are on our fourth marriage. Is that right? Explain that.
Harville Hendricks, mm-hmm. who wrote Imago Therapy, and I took a class from him or had a seminar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he said that every 7 years, if a coupleship is working well, you create a new union, you create a new connection. And the hope is that you have consecutive marriages with your same spouse. Person. And I think it has held true.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think
we're at the end of of 28 years in it. And I do feel like some fresh air.
Yeah.
Coming for us.
Or re-upping for maybe a new honeymoon. Yeah. Ooh,
I would take a new honeymoon.
It's those seven, I think it's right. I look back on 30 years. First of all, it's crazy. 30 years. I mean,
I know.
It's crazy.
I know.
And I think about like what we've been through together and separately and the way that you've remained my best friend. And we've been for each other and we've turned against each other. We've had all
we've
of those
the
things,
whole
right?
thing.
We've done the
whole
thing. We've laughed, we've cried. I think that's amazing. So you're a therapist?
I'm a therapist.
Yeah, tell me about that. Where do you work? What do you do?
I work at Keggy Family Counseling. And it's been a new season in my life. Mm. You know this, my dad passed away in September after 6 really long years of stage 4 cancer. Mm. And it was a year ago and some that I told him when he was first on hospice that I was going to do whatever it took to get my license reinstated. It had lapsed due to paperwork challenges and, you know, the system back then wasn't very forgiving. Mm. So, I was needed at home with the boys.
Yeah.
In their later teenage years, it doesn't always get easier. It gets different and they still needed me to be available. So, I joined Keggy Family Counseling in the fall and just have been slowly working in that way and really am drawn to working in the addiction sphere mm-hmm. of treatment because...
Could you know a couple? Works out well.
I know a few. I know.
Just bringing your work home, babe.
I know the journey. I know. Well, it's an inside job and a relational job, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm a person in long-term recovery, and I'm grateful that the journey of recovery has returned me to myself.
Yeah.
And it's returned us to one another.
Yeah.
In a way, I don't know.
We wouldn't be here.
Wouldn't have been possible without that.
Yeah.
And then it's proved to be necessary every step of the way.
Yeah.
Raising our boys and trying to be, the parents that we both want to be.
Yeah.
So getting my license reinstated and making the decision to work in the addiction treatment sphere to support folks directly in recovery and their loved ones because addiction
deal.
Is a family disease and it affects the functioning of every member, whether we want to acknowledge that truth or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I feel really honored to be in that space and to work with my colleagues every day and to work with people who want to recover.
It's a wonderful team of people you get to work with there too.
Yeah,
so it's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things it's hard to have these conversations, not with you, but because it feels like so much of the things that I get to talk about, in communities that I've been in, whether it's been Mercy Street or St. Paul's, back here at Chapel, just been so rich. The Crossing have really emerged out of are discussions that we have a lot in private.
Yeah.
You know, and even running down the things that I got to run down during my PhD, and even now thinking through various things that a lot of my faith development has been attached to our relationship and our friendship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in places where I feel like you've gone on before me, and I'm like, oh, you can think those kind of thoughts and still, you know, or maybe in a lesser degree me, but it feels like that we've been like pretty amazing conversational partners in some really, you know, key aspects of our own development. I love that. So,
yeah. I agree with that. Mm. I agree with that. And I fell in love with, that part of you that was seeking truth in a deeper way than our evangelical Christian upbringings afforded us.
Yeah.
And I feel like we had more courage together to ask the questions like, is this what God intended?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the light like that we long for?
Yeah.
And we were really young, but we had already, you know, you had faced so many traumas in your family with your mom's brain cancer. And, you know, the traumas in my family were a little more hidden.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand the forces of it until I started doing some of the work to be a therapist, right? That we had both encountered some real difficulties in our families. And I think it caused us to question, like, is this the light and the life and the God that makes sense, or maybe is there more than our upbringing allowed us to explore?
Yeah, that's right. This last week, we're in a series at Chapelwood, really where we're discovering and kind of walking through the Epistle of John, and John Stevens, in kind of just the way that he's framing and visioning kind of the place, one of the places that we were starting in the book of John was Christ as light this last week, because he's suffering for Jesus in Corfu or Greece. I forget where he is.
Poor soul. We feel really...
In Joseph Clam. And
right. We have no feelings about that.
In Greece. Yeah. I think I said on Sunday, if Paul's trip took him through Waxahachie,
we wouldn't care about that.
I think a bunch of us be going up there visiting.
We would, but it would.
Yeah.
It would be.
Be a Bucky's stop. But anyway, but one of the things that that John says is that that God is light, and it really got me thinking about some conversations we've had, and really what I was attempting to do last Sunday was in some ways was to bear witness to some of the both the faith developments that you and I have kind of walked through with each other and where we are now and some of the things that are happening at the Crossing in terms of the Sunday school class that we're a part of, where we're attempting to at least discern the outer edges of faith. What does it mean to mature?
Yeah.
And so partly what we've discovered there is if what you believe at 15 is the same thing you believe at 50, you haven't grown. Mm-hmm. And that often we're given a map, that religion gives us a map and says, this is the map. And when we get to the edge of the map, we don't know what to do. So religion will say, oh, go back here and do this more or dig deeper here. And so we do that. But I think faith always leads us to the edge of the map to step off.
Mm-hmm.
But when we step off the map of religion, we don't step off the heart of God.
Absolutely.
And so part of what we were looking at last week, and I'd like to have more of an open conversation with you about kind of faith and about what it means to believe something as a child, to have faith as a child, and have a belief system as a child, but how do you mature in that? And then what does faith do then? Does it protect you, not protect you?
Yeah.
What's the purpose of it? All those things. Right. So, yeah.
Right. I loved your example that day. I don't think I ever talked to you about it after, about the Frenchman and that work he created. And it resonated with me, right? Because my father, who was also my minister, right? So it was tricky
for
me.
He was also blind.
Right. So he became completely blind 17 years ago from glaucoma. And, you know, my dad was tricky on one level. He loved Jesus so thoroughly into the depths of his soul. And I always, I both felt in awe of it and confused by it because it often came packaged with some fundamentalist ideas. And so I struggled because the message I got growing up, well into my 20s, as he and I would debate, which we always did, was, you know, God isn't that concerned with who we are as people, and that we have to be very suspicious of, you know, humanism and the worship of the human soul, and we need to be very suspicious of psychology.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being the person that I am, and I really feel like I was seeking the light of God.
Yeah.
Because I recognized very early, even though there was a very faith-based family, there was a lot of trauma and pain that I could see. And I think God just gave me the kind of personality, the kind of wiring that was always going to be aware that there was pain.
Yeah.
So it's the challenge that so many of us face. Like, we're seeing and we're hearing the message that, you know, to die is to live in Christ, you know, to die to self. But I was like, what is the self we're leaving behind?
Mm.
And I think God is really curious about the self and not threatened by, you know, the challenges we face. Mm. And for me, the religious solution didn't seem to be working because there were so many dynamics of avoidance and conflict and loneliness in my family growing up.
Could you define that thing that you call the religious experience, right? What did that mean for you? Does it, a certain way of believing or act, you know, what did that entail?
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know if I can express it, so maybe you can help me accurately, because I think you also lived it.
Mm.
So you're the theologian you. I can just say that as a young child, we were in church Sunday night, Monday night for prayer service, and Wednesday. And because my dad was a minister, every other day to pick up the mail. And so true.
That's awesome.
I was like, really? Are we going back to the church again?
Go back to church to get mail.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. I never thought of that. It was, yeah.
And you got to get groceries this week, baby.
even when dad was so sick this last year, you know, like one of the last things is like, did you check the mail?
Yeah.
There were no checks coming in, I guarantee you. It's hilarious. But yeah, so it's more like, you know, I grew up in a church where, you know, dinosaurs weren't real. Creationism was the only way to understand the phenomenon of God creating the planet. And that there, you know, there wasn't an open discussion. So I found it really hard to develop the skills I needed in that system, right? And so I believed God was real and true. But there were a lot of extraneous, what's the word?
Yeah, that's right.
Circumstances that felt like I had to be cut off from, you know, my body, my mind, my emotions.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't a place for God in God for those things.
I think that's right. And in a lot of ways that I think religion structures things is through like a belief, a cognitive belief, believe these things. And I wonder if, as I'm looking back, there's so much of our experiences where we feel out of control, you know, in our own recovery. That's one of the things that is attended to, like, right off the rip, you know, is that, like, what control do I have and what control do I not have? I think in growing into adulthood, I realized, oh, I don't have near as much control as I want, right? Or is that I need to be able to live, you know?
I mean, especially when when someone we love's well-being is threatened.
Yeah.
That's a really profound experience. Like, I thought I had more control than I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes that's just overwhelming to the mind.
I think then religion comes in and says, let me show you, you know, how control is manifest in the world through this, through system. God, this system that you access through your brain, that everything happens for a reason and there's a big plan that's placed over it, right? And other lies that we're told.
Yeah.
In a sense, or that we believe for a while. And I think then I come to kind of the Fowler stages of development, you know, faith development. And I realize, that's a very early stage development that's important that then graduates into, I think, larger spaces of trust.
Right.
You know, not of control.
Right. I mean, we shouldn't have to employ control and denial in our expression and growth in faith. And I think we shouldn't, right? And the thing I came to understand...
Can we just pause right there for a second? Yeah. Because I think that's huge. Because you throw that away, like, you know, we shouldn't have to, but most of our faith development is don't doubt, right?
Don't doubt. Don't question.
Don't question.
And don't feel.
And believe more. Which believes more is like suspend and be very earnest.
Yeah. Well...
can be operationalized as that.
Yeah. I mean, I had the opportunity to watch how my dad's faith changed over 53 and a half years.
Yes.
And so there was something absolutely real in his expression and experience.
100%.
But it also, I think the limitations mapped really closely to some of the traumas he was not able to discuss, you know, like until the end of his life. And I was like, Dad, are you sure there wasn't some pretty serious... alcohol addiction and at play in your family? No. Like, you know, he just couldn't go there. I mean, he was also hospitalized for a year with polio
as a kid
at 8. And he was absolutely growing in an alcoholic family system. I mean, what he was able to acknowledge in the last month or so of his life was like, wow, I mean, the man was holding on to so much pain.
Yeah.
So much pain emotionally. And I think he found a place in God to place those fears and the constrictions within himself. I think he did make peace, but it was really hard to be a person not traumatized directly, to be trying to find how you mature emotionally, how you make peace with your own emotions, how you express them, how you communicate your needs and wants. You know, so there was that gap.
Yeah.
And I think all of us live in that gap. We aspire to be free. And the reality is when things get really dark and difficult and people's lives are at risk or we're in our own health challenge, that we find it really difficult to not also get caught up in some of the ways we protect ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that in the place that at least that we're discovering and have discovered probably since, you know, we've been in seminary together with Ray Anderson and some other folks we read, is that I have this profound sense that that this person, Jesus, like, and Ray talked about this beloved professor of ours, that Jesus descends into our humanity. I think for most of my life, I was really trying to be a good person and thinking if I could cut off parts of myself that didn't feel good, that I would be more acceptable and maybe I would feel better as a person. Yeah. And maybe that would affect things around me. And not only did that not work.
How'd that work out for you?
that created some deepening shadows in my life. That it wasn't until I realized that the descent of Jesus wasn't just so that I didn't descend. It was the model of what happens to all of us that and then I think, oh, yeah, this is what, you know, Jung talks about, the necessary wounding. Our egos, our souls have to be wounded so that, and often then our breakdowns become a breakthrough.
Yeah.
But the way that a type of Christianity was legitimated for me growing up was, oh, if you believe this or do this right, you can bypass the breakdown.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah,
and only folks that are losers in Jesus break down. And those folks, and they're off doing crazy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but in here, in this thing called, you know, Christianity or the way of Jesus, we don't break down if we believe and if we do it right.
Yeah. Right? That was the message.
Yeah. And I think the way that we're starting to understand, and globally, not just like we're bringing this now on this podcast to the world, what we're understanding globally is, oh, there's a limitation to that belief that as Christians, if Jesus descends into our humanity, the utterness of it, addiction, you know, desires, you know, defenses, whatever you want to call them, whatever language, that's the place that we have to, what you say, I love that phrase you've helped me with, tend and befriend. Mm. We can't make those enemies,
right?
You know?
Yeah. If we could cut the parts off from our being and how we operate in the world, like if we could do that in a deep and thorough way, like that would be fantastic. But that's just not the reality. Mm-hmm. The reality is even the addict part is trying to protect the essence of who we are from what a painful world we can live in.
Yeah.
And even the addict part plays a role in our survival for a time.
Yes.
Because it gives us a reprieve from the dark, challenging, disturbing emotions that are part of the human experience. And so whether it's an addict part or a perfectionism part or an uber controlling part that we're bringing to the table trying to navigate, all of those parts are really trying to preserve the essence of who we are in a dangerous and threatening world. And so, so we're not doing ourselves, I'm not doing myself a service by just living in some level of shame that, you know, I'm a fraud, I'm a fake, because I do the things I don't want to do, whether that's relationally or with substances or shopping.
It's a whole other podcast, folks.
It's a whole other. Right. If I attack those parts, then I'm attacking a part that has helped me, that sustained me through hard times till I could get to a safer place with safer people, with people I trust, people, you know, maybe not with the limitations that my parents had, but like Ray Anderson, you know, from the earliest days. I mean, I was 22. You were much older at 25.
Easy.
And, you know, we sat in his class and he gave us permission to think thoughts that had been off limits.
Yes.
And he helped knit back together our humanity that God sees that and values our humanity.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I think that's the first time I realized the map I had was smaller than the map that was.
Right.
And that, you know, and it continues just to expand to where I'm like, oh, there's not a map going. I mean, in that regard.
Yeah. And he had some pretty strong language.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, you know, he said that to deny our humanity is a form of spiritual malpractice that is so much more damaging than the solution it's trying to offer. And I'll never forget, we were at a big church in Glendale, California, and the pastor was talking about, you know, like everything in this life, everything comes from the hand of God. And that I could not square that with the abuse that members of my family had experienced. And I was just like, what is it about this belief that's so deeply triggering? And if that's God, and if God designs that, then that's a really abusive God. And I want no part of that.
Yeah.
And Ray gave me the hope that not everyone believed in that way.
Yeah.
And that I could see that differently. And that helped me stay in the game. It helped me continue to seek God's presence.
Yeah. I'm really interested in communities like Chapel and other places, because often I think the church has been conceived as a place where you go and learn ideas or concepts about a faith tradition. Mm-hmm. And then you're confirmed by knowledge you gain in that. I really wonder, like I think we're coming to an end of an era and a new era.
Yeah.
Not just our marriage, but maybe the whole tracking what's happening globally.
Yeah.
Is that, I wonder, like, and I think Brian McLaren talks about this a little, that the church ought to be a school of love.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. It ought to be a school of like where we're teaching to where we see an addict walk in and mm-hmm. we don't, and I get that we put them in the basement of churches or, you know, all the places they ought to be. But we ought to be able to say, oh, I'm really curious about like what that person is defending or their own human, their experience that led them to that. Yeah. Often I was taught that there's bad parts. You know,
yeah,
and you've got a mentor that says there's no bad parts.
There's no bad parts,
right?
Yeah, I mean, I was taught the same. There's no bad parts. The problem with that is there's no path for healing.
Yeah,
there's no actual deep appreciation or compassion for how the parts have saved us. You know, Marcus Mumford has a song. You know, better off high than dead. Now, I'm not suggesting that. That using provides a long-term solution. But there's a part of me that resonates with that reality. You know, the really painful part is that, you know, and it takes a while for us to see that the solution, if it's in case of a chemical or substance or process addiction, is that it's also killing us simultaneously. Yeah. And that's just a reality. It provides temporary relief for a much deeper, longer term challenge and place that needs to be healed. So I think that it's, really striking and true. And I heard someone in the field say yesterday, for the people who recover or enter into long-term sobriety really often have a spiritual awakening on a level. And that then becomes a fuel, a connection that helps face life on life's terms.
Mm.
And there are lots of treatments for addiction, but I think ultimately getting reconnected to a power greater than yourself. Mm-hmm. And for some people really need to lean on that language because churches have often created harm.
Mm-hmm.
For people in really deep ways, in the same way they've also afforded opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I don't know if this is Gabor Mate who said this, but the opposite of addiction is not recovery. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Right.
And I have the tendency to think that, like, that's really the antidote to most things,
mm-hmm.
you know, is connection.
Right.
And for a religious community like the church to have any place moving forward,
right.
I think it has to figure out how to open up connection rather than to create criteria for which if you jump through these hoops, you get connection. Right?
Yeah.
And part of that kind of goes back to that deep sense that we have that you and I have discovered kind of along the way that our believing, this is Michael Polanyi, this philosopher that we love, our believing at its source is conditioned upon our belonging.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And often since the Enlightenment, since we've kind of things go through our brains and we say, oh, this is the truth. We'll reduce these thoughts to the real essential stuff. And if you believe this, you'll get it.
Yeah.
Rather than saying, actually,
it was all that
the
right.
whole delivery system is in the belonging.
Yeah.
The only thing I've been able to like change about myself, is when I've realized I've trusted the person across from me, literally, that would love me in places I couldn't love myself. Mm-hmm. And I belonging creates that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The ability to share secrets and all those things that, you know,
yeah.
the church has to reclaim that to have any value in the world.
You know, in the last couple months, you've had a number of really amazing classes at the Crossing. You have.
Can you say that again?
You have.
Thank you.
You have.
Time stamp that. It's going to be my ringtone.
In fact, like, you know, not everyone gets to have this experience, but, you know, I have been really moved by the things that you've shared, and it's all out of that vein that are, that it's not what we believe. It's that we find a deep place of belonging and we are given the permission that we needed 30 years ago.
Yes.
As, you know, during our engagement and quickly after marriage, that like, yeah, we both survived the challenges of growing up with lots of trauma, and the things that we were obsessed about and the things we compulsively did that took us deeply from ourselves and the experience of God as we understood God at that time. And I fall in love with you more when I hear you speaking on that level, because it's true. I do. No, like something very different happens, I think, in you when you're in a surrender place and you're sharing, you're learning. And I think that kind of permission giving is really vital for all of us. And it's that gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah.
You know, and then you look around and you see people leaning in, because most of the time, most of the experience in our Western, you know, Christian tradition is you leave major swaths of yourself at the door and you walk in and you take communion and you hope that God can do something to you.
Yes. Yes.
In spite of yourself, right?
Just do it to me.
Like, just do it. Bring it. Yeah. I want that power. Yeah. And actually, like, we've missed the reality that God is wanting to work with us in a tender and loving and compassionate space to say, like, all your parts belong.
Yeah. So friggin' un-American what you're talking about, though, right? Because it's slow. It's not instantaneous. It requires a different imaginational way of seeing, right?
Yeah. It asks us to operate on a different basis.
Yes.
But the basis is like bringing all of us, not just the part that we've shined up for church.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
In fact, it requires the parts we haven't shined up for church.
It requires those parts so much, because most of the things we're shining up for other people to see is, you know, it's just another defense to what's really happening. And how can we in the villages of Houston, Texas, be transparent? It just doesn't work. That kind of vulnerability is not appealing to anyone, you know, whether there's external pressures or not.
Yeah.
No one wants to feel their vulnerability, but I think that's what God's asking us to come into a space where it's safe to be honest, vulnerable about our own struggles, and then to see that God's light and love and compassion expand, you know, all the way to the depths of those places.
Yeah. I often wonder how much time we have spent propping up something that doesn't need to prop up. In our fear, in our shame, all of those things. And I think I get excited about this place, about Chapelwood, about what we're doing, like what the vision that John's leading here in that regard, of saying we really are on a cusp of imagining the church into itself, right? And it's not what's behind us. That will fuel a deep sense of our own rootedness, but it's what's ahead of how the church and communities like this can begin to shift and adjust to open up its borders, not close them down, to figure out, oh, we've got a God that crosses every border is a border crosser. We've got a God that shows up and says, you know, in fact, the things that shame you, let's go talk about those and let's offload those and let's move through that. I think those things are huge. So,
Yeah, I think, the question is like about light and returning to a place where we can see the light and love of God operating in us. And I didn't have quite an appreciation for, and one of my brilliant mentors said this last week, you know, the essence of who we are, our child of God self, you know, there's a name for it in every religion.
Yes.
And in a lot of psychology, yes.
Carl
Jung talked about the true self versus the false self. Right. What I didn't understand is that the essence of who I am can be eclipsed by some of my strategies for coping and surviving in this world. And so I think addiction is a really powerful example, like how addiction numbs us to the pain. We use different substances for very particular reasons. Mm-hmm. And I never could appreciate how that blocked my awareness of God's light and life in me. It also blocked my perspective to see that I was loved without condition. And so, you know, an addiction is one example, but you know, every time I got stressed out in our house, I was cleaning for hours and purging, you know, your pillow, our belongings, the things that were sentimental to the kids, because I was like, something has to change here, you know, and if I can tidy it up, if I can clean it and organize it, I can feel a deeper peace within myself. And the cruel thing is I would feel more peaceful, but it was always temporary and it was conditioned on a lot of hard work.
Yes.
And so whether it's perfectionism or, you know, alcoholism or some other major process, it's those things that orbit our emotional atmosphere that both protect us and eclipse us simultaneously. And it's really not until we are in a safe place physically, emotionally, where we're not being harmed, that we can begin to ask ourselves, like, what do I need in this life to recover who I was meant to be? I remember when I was 4, I had a sense of freedom and love and rightness. Maybe it was younger. Maybe a person never experienced that. But I feel like that's really hopeful that God says, no matter where you've been, what you've done, who you've done it with, the essence of who you are cannot be eclipsed forever.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. Yeah. What did we go to find out about?
Keggy Family Counseling.com. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a really powerful place for assessments, for direction, for exploration of what substances are, you know, how those are playing a role in your life and maybe blocking who you're meant to be on this planet and all the good and the love that you want to share.
Yeah.
So folks who are tired of the battle within themselves. So Keggy Family Counseling, we'll have links to all the therapists. We offer group therapy, individual outpatient, partial hospitalization program. And, the brilliant thing is, we have contracts with lots of insurance companies, so people are finding help and getting reimbursement for their services. And so it's just
That's great. Some rapid fire questions. What are like one or two books that you've read that have had an impact on your life? Quickly, like you know.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not going to be any help
there. Here we go, folks.
I mean, most of the things I watch and listen to in podcasts are all oriented to clinicians, but
but that's okay. Like some
No Bad Parts
by
Richard Schwartz.
What podcasts are you listening to? Do you have a consistent podcast you listen to?
I listen to a lot of Spotify soundtracks for anxiety. I listened to a lot of.
You recommend that.
It was going last night.
I love it.
Yeah,
dude, I was like sleeping like a baby.
I was like, man, if music can do something for this brain and for this for the daily stress. So that podcast.
What shows are you watching on Netflix or whatever that you like?
Anything World War II, you know.
That's really true.
So sad when I got through The New Look and, you know.
Was that a product?
I don't think any of those things people are going to find helpful other than, like, I highly recommend them.
But, I mean, I think it's coming back from England, and I think we had watched, I mean, we have watched every World War II documentary show.
I don't know. Crevice. There's just something.
You know more about the Nazis than anybody I've ever met. You know? Just about, yeah. Okay, Houston Astros or the Seattle
what are you even Mariners? Asking?
Just that's a,
Mariners.
Okay, wow.
Mariners.
Okay, what about Seattle Seahawks versus so the Houston Texans?
I don't know. C.J. Stroud is a good force. You see what we're getting good, this? Yeah, like, so I'll always be a Seahawk first, and I'm grieving Pete Carroll's retirement, yeah. And don't even bring up the University of Washington Huskies.
Okay. Yeah.
Crushed me. But they did, yeah, they did last have the best great. Season ever. So, yeah.
Michelle, thanks for being here. I'll see you tonight. I'm Matt Russell.
I'm Michelle Russell.
And this is Pod Have Mercy.